congregation find this day, the rest and the appreciation from your loved ones. I was just thinking, it's just too bad that we only designate one day a year to be Mother's Day. I was thinking, every day should be Mother's Day, because your heroism is demonstrated to so many every day of the year. And I hope today's message will not only make you feel good, and I hope that you may be encouraged to see what you are and what you do every day can impact so many for good. We all need heroes. We all need models. And that is why I have chosen the book of Esther for our study at this particular time. I said last week, I chose Esther for the reason that I have never preached from it. But then there are other books in the Bible that I have never preached from. Why not preach from the book of Ezra? Someone brought it up last week. I've never preached from the book of Ezra. And I said last week that maybe I will preach Ezra next year. But the biggest reason why I have chosen Esther is because May is the time for Mother's Day. I was looking for heroine, women heroes in the Bible, to encourage our mothers. And what great impact women can make in our world. And it is Esther. When she was put into positions of influence, she rose to the occasion and she saved an entire race. She seized the moment and made her life count. The key verse in the entire book of Esther is the passage that we just read. Esther chapter 4, verses 13 and 14. Mordecai sent back his answer. And Mordecai said to Esther, "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will come from another place. But you and your family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this." For such a time as this. This is the message of the book of Esther. And this is what God has to say to us, and particularly to the women and to the mothers among us. For such a time as this. First of all, we need to ask, what kind of a time was this? What kind of a time was it for Esther? First of all, it was a time of great and imminent danger. And then it was also a time of great personal risk. And finally, it was a time when God demonstrated his providence. Let's look carefully again at the great and imminent danger. Now, when we go to the book of Esther, we see that once again the entire Jewish race was facing another Holocaust. I have lost count how many times this is. There were Holocausts before, there were Holocaust sins, and this is, I don't know which number this is. Haman the Amalekite has been raised to prominent position, to the highest position in the entire Persian Empire. I mean, it was like 81 years ago when some minuscule Austrian corporal was also raised to the highest position in Germany. By law, everyone in the Persian Empire gave allegiance and gave honor and gave obedience to Haman. And some 81 years ago, by law, everyone in Germany and Austria, at least in Czechoslovakia, were required to give the total allegiance and honor and obedience to one Austrian corporal. But in Esther's time, everyone gave allegiance and honor to Haman except one, except Mordecai. And it was not long before Haman found out about Mordecai's defiance. Haman also found out that Mordecai was a Jew. Now, Haman's hatred was directed not only against one person. Haman's hatred now is directed toward an entire race. He went to King Xerxes and got the king's permission to annihilate and to exterminate the entire Jewish race. A date was set to carry out the final solution. And you read chapter 3, the date was said to be on the 13th day of the 12th month. Now the entire Jewish race had exactly 12 months to live. 12 months. What will you do in 12 months if you know that in May 2015, you're going to be exterminated? What were the Jews going to do? What options do they have? You know, I've been thinking. I mean, I thought they should have risen up in armed rebellion. I often watch documentary films showing how the Nazis herded the European Jews into cattle cars and sent them rumbling toward thousands and thousands of extermination camps. They were so docile. They were so passive. They were so resigned. I thought to myself, they knew they were being sent to their death. Why not at least fight back? Even if they should only take down one German with them, they would have died with greater dignity. I couldn't understand why the Jews were so submissive and so pacifist 80-some years ago. And what about the Jews in the time of Esther? They were faced with the same imminent danger of extermination. Why didn't they take up arms and fight back? I believe if they had taken arms to resist, they would have given Haman justification for his policy of extermination. You see, Haman had justified his evil by convincing Xerxes that the Jews were rebellious. He had justified his extermination policy by convincing Xerxes, the Persian king, that the Jews were threatening Persian security, that they were endangering the interests of the Persian Empire. Now, if the Jews had taken up arms to resist, the extermination were indeed justified. So what other options did they have? Really, there wasn't any other options. So their reaction was panic and grief. That was the time of Esther. It was a time of panic. It was a time of despair. It was a time of grief. Look at verse 3 in chapter 4. Verse 3 in chapter 4 tells us that in every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and in ashes. Now fasting, weeping, and wailing, laying down and wearing sackcloth and laying down and covered with ashes, they were traditional ways of expressing their despair and pain and grief. They could not take up arms in rebellion. They thought their only option was just a display of desperation. Mordecai was among those that started wearing sackcloth. But he knew there was a second option. He knew that it was no accident that Esther should be so attractive. He knew that it was no accident that Esther should be chosen as a replacement for Vashti. He knew that there was no accident that Esther was now in the palace as a favored queen of Xerxes. He knew it was God's providential hand that has placed Esther in her position for such a time as this. But how was he going to send word to Esther? We have to remember Esther was in the inner chamber of the palace. Esther was a favored queen in Xerxes' harem. And no man can get near such a place in the palace unless you were an eunuch. Again, we see God's providential hand at work. Mordecai could not get words into the inner palace, but it was Esther who came to Mordecai first. You see, words of Mordecai's grief have reached Esther. Esther's maid and Esther's eunuch have reported the news to her. And Esther could not understand why Mordecai was in mourning. You see, we also have to remember, Mordecai was the adopted father of Esther. Esther had no awareness of Haman's conspiracy and extermination policy. Esther did not know. She was not aware of the imminent danger facing the Jews. She was not aware of the reason why Mordecai was in such despair and pain. All she knew at the moment was that her father was in mourning. She had to be asking the question, who in the family died? She had to be asking, if nobody had died, why would my father be wearing sackcloth? So she sent regular clothes to Mordecai. But Mordecai refused to wear them. Now that got Esther even more distressed. So Esther sent another eunuch by the name of Hathach, one of the eunuchs and ordered him to find out the bottom of Mordecai's trouble. Now Mordecai told everything to the eunuch. Mordecai told the eunuch the details of Haman's plan. Mordecai told the eunuch the detail of Xerxes' edict. Mordecai told the eunuch the details of how long the Jews had left to live. And at the end, this is the most important, at the end, Mordecai sent the message to Esther. Go to Xerxes, personally and directly in his presence. Do not go through an intermediary. Go personally and directly. Beg him for mercy. Plead with him for your people. Now, that was a very reasonable request. I mean, Mordecai is a father. That was reasonable for him to ask Esther, his daughter, to do. Not only was it reasonable, there was an immediate urgency because the clock was ticking. There wasn't much time left. 13th day of the 12 months is just around the corner. Now, Esther sent word back to Mordecai. You see, at this point, we see there's a back and forth communication between Esther and Mordecai. And in her reply, Esther let Mordecai know that such was not only a time of great and imminent danger, but it was also a time of great risk and sacrifice for Esther herself. Esther explicitly explained to Mordecai, it was against Persian law to do what Mordecai is asking her to do. It was against the law of Persia for anyone, man or woman, to approach the king in the inner court without being summoned. No matter how important the official may be, no matter how favored the queen may be, penalty for violating such law was death, and there's no exception. The only way to be spared of execution was if Xerxes should grant clemency by extending his golden scepter toward the person, the violator of this law. And Esther added one more reminder. Esther said to Mordecai, you know, it has been 30 days since I was last summoned to go to the king. It was a long time ago since I was summoned. I may be beautiful, I may be favored, but I'm not the only one in the harem. Easily the king Xerxes would have forgotten me. Xerxes had many, many other women that he can choose from, that he can summon. And there's no way to say when I will be called again. And if I go to Xerxes without his summon, I'm risking my own life. If Xerxes could do what he did to Vashti, he could do the same thing to me. If Xerxes can just, you know, send Vashti down to whatever, he can do the same to me. Send me away. There's no way to tell what kind of mood Xerxes would be if I go to him unannounced and unsummoned. You see, such was a time. Not only was it a time of great and imminent danger to the entire race, it was a time of great personal risk to one person. It was a matter of life and death for even the most favored of queens. And thirdly, it was a time when God demonstrated his providence. Answer me this question, everyone. Does God need our help in order for him to accomplish his will? Does God need our help in order for him to accomplish his purposes? I hope you shake your head this way, because the answer is no. God does not need our help in order to accomplish his will and purpose. But he generally and he usually allow us to be involved with him to accomplish his will. He generally and usually allow us, invite us to be partners with him, to be the human agency to accomplish his will and purpose. There are so many examples. I don't know how many of you are in great pain and in great ache because you have been working so hard in yard work, because you have been working so hard in mowing and fertilizing and in spreading the weed killers in your lawn. How many of you are, or maybe you say, I hire people. If it were gospel and purpose that my lawn should be luscious and should be weed-free, he doesn't need my help. If it is God's will and purpose and that your lawn should be so beautiful and green and weed-free, he doesn't need your help. I'll read to you Psalm 104. The psalmist said he makes grass grow for the cattle and plants for man to cultivate, bringing forth food from the earth. Oh, I wish it was God's will that my lawn should grow beautifully so that he would say to me, Benjamin, you can just sit right there and vegetate in front of the TV. I just want you to do nothing. Just sit back and watch how I make your grass grow. I mean, God has the power and the authority to cause my lawn to grow, to be the envy of the neighborhood, if it were his will and purpose. But he usually invites me to do my responsibility, to mow, to fertilize, to insecticide, to, I don't know what else, or herbicide, and kill all kinds of bad things in there. Could God bring forth wheat and rice from the soil without human agency, without human help? I know some of you are already planted in your garden. I'm sure some of you have already put in your fuqua seeds and whatnot. All right? I mean, does God need your help to cause that fuqua to grow? He doesn't. But he generally and usually invites farmers and invites you to be partners with him, to be the human agency, to plant, to cultivate, to fertilize, and to harvest. Could God direct the events of the nations to make some nations to be great and to bring some nations to be evil, to bring down some nations and to shrink the border of some nations without human help? Sure he can. The book of Job, verse 12, tells us that he makes nations great and destroys them. He enlarges nations and disperses them. God could have brought down a nation without anyone else's help. But he generally and usually invites us to be partners with him to make nation great or to make a nation weak. God generally and usually invites us to be his human agency, to enlarge a nation or to shrink a nation. God could have made this nation great without the help of people like Washington or Madison or Lincoln. But he uses them as his human agency. God could have destroyed Germany without the help of the Nazis, but he uses them to be his human agency. God could have shrunk the British Empire. 150 years ago, there's a saying that there's no sun setting on the British Empire, because the British Empire was so great, so large, it encompassed the entire globe, the entire world, that if the sun should set on the British Empire in Asia, it's rising in Europe and in Africa. It was a huge, huge empire. God could have shrunk the British Empire to the present size without the help of the two world wars. God used the Germans as a human agency. This is the one vital meaning of the teaching of God's providence that is taught in the Bible. God could and God would accomplish his will and purpose without human agency, without our help. But he usually and he generally invites us to partner with him, to be the instrument and agency to accomplish his will and purpose. So next time you are faced with life-threatening illness, don't just pray. Of course, God could and God would heal you by just prayer, as some Christian circles believe. God could and God would. But God generally and usually invites physicians and use medicine to accomplish his will and purpose. This is exactly what we see in the life of Esther. Mordecai had asked her to approach Xerxes to plead with him for her people. And Esther answered very reasonably. Esther said, it's against the law. It is a capital offense. It is a great risk to me. She is really thinking and asking this: does God really need my help to save the Jews? The answer is, of course not. God doesn't need Esther's help. But look at verse 14. Mordecai's answer is this: but if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. Mordecai is saying, God does not need your help, Esther. If you care for your own safety more than the fate of your entire people, if you remain silent, the Jews will survive. If you remain silent, deliverance will come from another place. God does not need you in order to accomplish His will and purpose. God could have and God would have used another person and another means, but He has placed you in your position. He has asked you and invite you to be His partners, and it is your responsibility to rise to the occasion and obey. And if you disobey, if you are indifferent, that will bring disastrous consequences to you and to your family, because your silence is disobedience to God, and your disobedience will bring God's judgment on you. And that's exactly what we read in verse 13. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. If you remain silent at this time, you and your father's family will perish. What is God saying to Esther, and what is God saying to us? God is addressing the problem of evil with this book. Here's the biggest, most puzzling, most paradoxical of questions and truth. If God is in control of all events, that's the teaching of providence. If God causes all events, if God preordained all events to happen, and God knows the outcome of all events, then what about evil? Who is responsible for evil? The one who does evil, or God who preordained the evil? The person who committed evil, or God who brought about the evil? Now, how does the book of Esther answer this unanswerable question? The book of Esther tells us God's providence preordained all events, even events of evil. And yet, God is never held responsible for evil. Only the person who commits the act of evil is responsible. The evil event facing Esther is a decision to speak up or to be silent. To speak up will cost her life. To be silent is to be disobedient to God. And it's a miserable choice anybody has to make. And you realize that we are faced with choices like this all the time. We should be very familiar with a German by the name of Martin Niemöller. Martin Niemöller died exactly 30 years ago. 30 years ago at the age of 92. So he lived a long and fruitful life. He was a German pastor. But between the years 1938 and 1945, he was in prison. He was an inmate in the Nazi concentration camp. After he was liberated, he started preaching again. He started giving lecture. And he is best remembered for this quotation. He said when they first came for the socialites, when they first came for the socialists, they meaning the Gestapo, the German secret police, when they first came for the socialists, I did not speak up because I was not a socialist. Now, a socialist is a leftist. Then they came for the trade unionists, but I did not speak up because I was not a trade unionist. Now, trade unionist means they are leftist. Then they came for the communists. I did not speak up because I was not a communist. Then they came for the Jews. I did not speak up because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me. And that time there was no one left to speak for me. To be silent is to do great evil. In Esther's time and in our time, both Esther and Martin Niemöller were faced with their free will to choose, to speak up or to be silent. Even though God's providence tells us that God preordained all events, so the choice that Esther made and Niemöller made, they were preordained by God too. And yet we say that their choice was still a genuine free act of a person. If they obey God and speak up, it will be an act of great courage and risk, personal risk, but they will be faithful. But if they disobey God and remain silent, they will be responsible for the evil they did. Even though God's providence tells us God has caused their disobedience and silence. The Bible tells us that God is never to be blamed, but the person who did evil is responsible. How do you explain these two paradoxes? The first paradox is all events are caused and ordained by God, and yet the choice we make are fully and genuinely free. If I choose to buy, I don't know, an F-115 pickup truck to be my next car, the teaching of Providence says that God preordained that I should buy an F-150. But yet that choice is a genuine and truly free choice of mine. How do you explain that? We can. Paradox number two, all events may be evil, but it is still caused and preordained by God, and God is never to be blamed, and only the one who did evil is responsible. We have to admit that these are paradoxes that we cannot explain. But like all paradoxes in the Bible, or any paradox at all, when all the truth is known, they will not contradict. The Bible is full of paradoxes like that. The biggest paradox is in the book of Exodus in the Old Testament. Over 10 times you read the book of Exodus, when Moses went up to Pharaoh, the Bible said God hardened the hearts of Pharaoh. Pharaoh's refusal to let the Jews go, that was an act of great disobedience and an act of great evil. And yet the Bible says it was God who caused him to disobey. Well, if God causes all events, then his disobedience, his act of evil, was caused by God too. But the Bible never blamed God for that. It was Pharaoh who was responsible and paid the price for disobedience. And the greatest evil of all human events, the crucifixion, who was responsible for the evil of crucifying Christ? You read the fourth chapter of Acts, I'll read to you. The fourth chapter of Acts, verse 27, it says, indeed, Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel in this city to conspire against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. They did what your power and will had decided beforehand should happen. It was God who decided beforehand that the crucifixion must happen. God's power did that, and God's will preordained that. It was God who decided beforehand that these guilty people should crucify Christ. And yet the Bible never blamed God for the crucifixion. Right? The Bible praised God for the crucifixion because it demonstrated his love. But who is responsible for this evil? Acts chapter 2, verse 23. This is Peter preaching. He said, men of Israel, Jesus was handed over to you by God's set purpose and foreknowledge, and you, men of Israel, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. It was God's purpose, it was God's foreknowledge, but it was you, lawless, wicked men, who did the work of evil. And what about Judas? What was Judas in particular? What was his culpability? Luke 22. Luke said, the Son of Man will go as it has been decreed. Christ was crucified because of God's decree. It was God's order. It was God's will and purpose. But woe to that man who betrays him. You see, it was God's decree. The events of evil should take place. But it is the one who did evil who is responsible. We have to admit, we have to concede that these paradoxes we cannot explain. But like all paradoxes, when all truth is known, we will find out that there is no contradiction. So rather than to deny the truth of God's providence, it is far better for us to trust in the Word of God, that there is no contradiction in the Word of God. We may not be able to understand, we may not be able to explain the truth of God's predestination, the Word, but it sure gives us the best explanation to all these difficult passages in the Bible. And we see it right here in the choices that is facing Esther. If she obeys God and speaks up, she faces great risk to her own life. But if she disobeys and do evil by remaining silent, she will be just as responsible as Haman for the extermination of the Jews. And she and her father's family will perish as God's judgment. And to make a story short, Esther obeyed. Esther risked her life. Esther approached Xerxes, and she pleaded with Xerxes, and Xerxes granted her clemency for violating the Persian law, and showed her favor, and reversed the decree, and Esther saved the Jews. Esther now is a favorite name for many Christians and for Jews alike, and is a perfect, heroic model for Mother's Day. I hope you don't read this story like and say it's so corny. I hope you don't read this story and say, I mean, all these events are so melodramatic, so, oh, it's just like a soap opera. I mean, I don't think they're soap opera on Sunday, so let's read the book of Esther, you know. Some of us are really hooked on soap opera that, you know, from Monday to Friday, you have to watch them, and you'll go on cold turkey, you got to read something again on Sunday. I hope you don't look at it that way. Because this is the way God acts in the world. This is the way God works in human events. And this is the way God works in our lives. It's a timeless truth about us all. What kind of a time do we live in? Do we not also live in a time of great and imminent danger? I hear so many Christians cry out and complain, oh, our nation is sliding downward toward moral disintegration. Oh, it is so terrible. I mean, it was just like the time of Esther. You know, all the Jews, they were in sackcloth and in ashes, crying out in despair. Now you hear Christians, conservative Christians, crying out in despair just the same. But I always say, do not fear. Do not fear. It is very true, our nation is shrinking. Our nation is shrinking in greatness. Our nation is shrinking in power. Our nation is shrinking in moral strength. But do you think God needs our help in reversing our nation's downward slide toward moral disintegration? No, he doesn't. But God invites us to be partners with him. He invites us to be his human agency to reverse the course of our nation's downward slide and decline. Facing us is the same choice, to be silent or to speak up. And to speak up would put us into great risk. We face the risk of being called bigots if we speak up. We face the risk of being called, we are so exclusive. We are so conservative. You know the word evangelical is a dirty word? And that's why so many churches used to be called Baptist churches, but they changed it. They leave out the word Baptist anymore. Because being Baptist turns so many people off. But to be silent is to be partners with evil, and God will hold us responsible for being silent. These are times, and ours are times of great imminent danger. Not only for our nations, it's a larger picture, but even in a smaller picture, the danger our children are facing and exposed to. And that is far more relevant to us as mothers, as parents. You see, our children are exposed to the danger of falsehood and lies of the world. If we, as mothers and parents, if we do not influence them with the truth, God will use others. God will use their Sunday school teachers. God will use the YSMP mission ministry to influence your children with the truth. God will bring them relief and deliverance from the evil and lies of the world, from other places and from other people. When they go to college, God may bring them in the company of InterVarsity or Campus Crusade or other Christian groups. But if we remain silent and influence them, God will hold us responsible for being silent. If we should fail to pray and intercede for them, others will pray for your children, but God will hold you responsible for being silent. Or if we should fail to bring them up, training them up in loving God and worshiping and serving God, other people will train them up in your place, but God will hold you responsible for being silent. If we do not invite your loved ones to trust in Christ for salvation, God will use others, and God will hold you responsible for being silent. So dear mothers and dear parents of this dear congregation, we have worked so hard. We deserve a rest today. Yes, we do. We deserve appreciation from our children. Yes, we do. I mean, we have served them 1,000 meals in just the past 12 months. Yeah, we deserve to eat out tonight. Let them pay for it, even though the money is yours. These are dangerous times, Sunday. Dangerous times to our loved ones, dangerous time to our family, dangerous time to our nation. We stand in great risk for living in such dangerous times. But shall we rise up to the occasion and take ownership of the needs of the time? God has placed you and me, God has placed you, especially the mothers, as the mother of the family, for exactly a time such as this. And I pray and trust that you will rise up to the occasion and seize the moment and make your life count. Let's all stand together. We have a closing hymn to sing.